This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the premier law firm of Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about us, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where there's content on audio, video, and written content on taxes, estate planning, and business planning. And lastly, please read my column in the Washington Business Journal entitled Blueprint for Wealth, which appears once every month. Today, we're going to continue our discussion of the fiscal cliff. I'm pulling a lot of the content today from an article written by Tony Needy at Forbes magazine. It's a great article. If you want more information on his articles on the fiscal cliff, go to Forbes. And this article really, I think, nicely lays out some of the confusion that surrounds the fiscal cliff. And we don't, obviously, at this late stage in the game, I hope that Congress and the president can resolve the impasse and avoid us from having to fall over the fiscal cliff. But really, the question is, what is the fiscal cliff and what are its ancillary economic impacts on you individually and on the economy as a whole? The convergence of two events is really what the fiscal cliff is, and that happens on December the 31st. It's the expiration of almost every tax cut that was passed since 2001, mainly in the Bush administration, but several tax cuts also passed in the Obama administration, and a scheduled automatic reduction in government spending known as sequestration. Is it going to send the world off its orbit into outer space, into deep dark space, or shift the world balance of power? I don't know. I doubt that, but it could lead to some very severe consequences. While going over the cliff is going to improve our deficit problem that we've got, because it's going to reduce the deficit by adding net cash inflows, it also is going to cause our economy to drop. One of the predictions by the Congressional Budget Office is that real growth, gross domestic product, GDP, is going to drop by 0.5% if they let us fall over the fiscal cliff in 2013. That's known as negative growth. And also, unemployment would be scheduled to rise to as high as 9.1%, which essentially is going to kickstart a recession. And the reason why depends on which component of the fiscal cliff we're talking about, whether it's reduced spending or increased tax revenue, but it clearly is going to have a negative economic impact on the economy. And while the timing of the two events is merely coincidental, there's no denying that at a minimum, the required spending cuts are indirectly related to the expiring tax cuts. And that's because there's revenue that's lost resulting from the cuts, which contributed to our now bloated deficit, which in turn contributed to our need to cut spending even further. More directly, the changes in governmental spending are also the result of what happened back in 2011 when we hit the debt ceiling. Let me give you a little bit of background on that real quickly. For example, when the government wants to build a bridge or wage a war or pick up some extra padlocks for Area 51, they need a way to finance the expenditure. These funds come from one of two sources, either tax revenues or borrowing. For a number of years, the government has spent a lot more than it has collected in tax revenues, which means that it has to borrow to pay for the excess. And as you can imagine, consistently growing deficits and debt are a bad thing. Higher debt leads to a reduction in national savings. The interest on the debt leads to further reduction in savings. And all of this undermines investor and consumer confidence. It also jeopardizes the government's ability to continue to borrow at reasonable interest rates. And if you take all of these things combined, you may end up in a crisis similar to what Greece has experienced. Because of these potential consequences, we cannot allow Congress to run amok with their old corporate credit card. As a result, there's a maximum amount of debt that can be incurred by the government, and this maximum is referred to as the debt ceiling. Back in the summer of 2011, years of rampant spending in excess of tax revenues finally caught up to the government, and it maxed out its credit limit and ran up against the debt ceiling. Rather than risk defaulting on the existing debt, the government just raised the debt ceiling, but it essentially punished itself for spending too much by increasing its ability to spend by imposing certain punishments that are effectively the reductions in spending that are automatically going to take place on January the 1st. Before hitting that sequestration, it did give itself an out. The government agreed, the Congress and the president agreed, that if it could reach a decision on what cuts should be made by November of 2011, then sequestration would not be necessary. They appointed a bipartisan commission. Republicans and Democrats were supposed to participate in this bipartisan effort to cut the deficit. They couldn't reach an agreement by November of 2011. And so sequestration automatically will take place on January 1, 2013, because November 2011 came and went without any agreement being reached. So where do these spending cuts come in? Well, I also said earlier that the expiring Bush and Obama tax cuts are indirectly responsible for the reduction in federal spending. The tax cuts reduced rates, expanded credits, and increased deductions, which obviously reduced tax revenue and drove up the deficit and government's need to borrow beyond what it was projected to do. So the cuts that are coming out as a result of all of this are as follows. On the defense side, spending for 2013 is scheduled to be cut automatically by $24 billion, which doesn't sound a whole lot when you're talking about an overall deficit of $15 trillion, but it's still a significant amount of money. On non-defense programs, the government is going to cut spending automatically by at least $40 billion in 2013. And these reductions are focused primarily on Medicare programs. So cutting spending is not necessarily a bad thing because we're reducing our deficit. So is that really a bad thing? Well, the answer speaks to bigger issues regarding the fiscal cliff. We admit reduced spending is a good thing in the long run. When the government is spending less, the government is buying less, however. And those goods and services that would have been purchased for $65 billion or $64 billion are now taken out of the economy, which could lead to a short-term recession. Here's an example. If the required spending cuts prevent a bridge in Minnesota from getting built, there would be harmful direct and indirect impacts on the economy. If the bridge had been constructed, the government would purchase raw materials, steel, concrete, etc., and they'd be purchasing services, labor, making for a banner year for the lucky contractor that's building that Minnesota bridge. Kill the bridge, and all those direct inflows into the economy go with it. Taking it one step further, building the bridge requires a team of laborers who in turn would earn more disposable income that they could pump back into the economy, buying disposable razors and throw pillows and tickets to football games. Take the bridge away, and these workers hit the unemployment line. So what is the short-term impact caused by all of this? Well, according to the Congressional Budget Office, if the government opts to postpone the required spending cuts for 2 years, the economy would actually pick up 3.75% in gross domestic product and approximately 800,000 additional jobs would be added to the economy in 2013, as opposed to the recession that's predicted if we let sequestration occur automatically. How do the expiring Bush tax provisions fit in? Well, they're the other half of the fiscal cliff equation. As I mentioned earlier, and I've mentioned on several shows on Blueprint for Wealth, on January 1st, 2013, almost every major tax cut enacted since 2001 is set to expire. In addition, the Obamacare legislation, which contains several additional tax provisions increasing taxes, will take hold. As I've mentioned in the past, for simplicity's sake, I'll summarize those tax cuts very quickly. The Bush-era tax cuts cause the highest individual tax rate to drop down to 35%. When they expire, the highest individual tax rate goes up to 39.6%. Add on top of that the health care surtax, if you will, that was imposed by President Obama's health care legislation of 3.8%, potentially subjects dividend and interest and net investment income at the highest rate to a tax of 43.6%. The estate tax is also impacted significantly. The highest exemption that each individual enjoys goes from $5.12 million per person for gift, estate, and generation skipping transfer tax in 2012 and drops automatically to $1 million for gift and estate tax. The rates go up from 35% to 55%. Another significant one is the expiration of the alternative minimum tax patch. The expiration of that patch causes millions of taxpayers to be subject to the AMT in 2012. And the temporary payroll tax cut that was enacted way back at the beginning of 2011 and has continued into this year expires at the end of this year. So the impact of all of this is significant. If you want to know more about the impact of the tax cuts on you or how the fiscal cliff will affect you, give us a call at Odin Feldman and Pittleman at 703-218-2100 or visit us on the web at OFP Law. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Should a business use a DBA? Depending on the business marketing strategy, a business may need to use a doing business as name, also known as a DBA. For instance, a sole proprietor runs the business alone, and the business's legal name will be the sole proprietor's full name. But the proprietor may market the business's AAA appliances. In that case, the business's legal name is different than the name under which it operates and is known by the customers. The proprietor is using a DBA. A DBA is also known as a fictitious business name, and most states require that businesses register fictitious business names. Using a DBA is common practice for business. It usually is the cornerstone for marketing efforts, and some businesses may be barred by using it in some states because it may be used by other businesses. So it involves professional business entities that must be known by the names of their owners, or in other cases, using a DBA is permissible as long as it's registered. Check out our website for more information.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. And with me today are my special guests, Michael Heller and Sally Lee. Welcome, folks. Welcome to the show.
Good to see you, Wayne.
Thanks for having us.
I'm going to give you a little bit of background. They're from Pillar One Consulting, which is an HR consulting firm based in Washington, D.C. Michael Heller's career has been built on over 15 years of experience in strategic human resources, talent management, and technology consulting. He's been with Dell Tech, Digital Management, and Washington Consulting, and he led teams to develop innovative human capital management programs and initiatives. He also serves the community as a board member of Teardrops to Rainbows, which is dedicated to supporting families of children with cancer. And he earned his bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Connecticut and will complete his master's degree in human resources at Georgetown in 2013. Sally Lee has 15 years of experience in global consulting and professional services environments, which include KPMG and Booz Allen Hamilton. Her areas of expertise include talent acquisition, performance management, training and development, and career counseling and mentoring. Sally has her bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Maryland and a master's in organizational development from Johns Hopkins University, and she's a certified human capital strategist and has a certificate in optimizing human performance from SABA, right? Well, the economy has really killed us in this job market, hasn't it? I mean, we've been in some of the largest areas of impact in organizations, and you know, you all have seen some big companies. You've done a lot of consulting around the area. What trends do you think are going to emerge as we recover, if we recover?
Well, Wayne, I think we're definitely going to recover.
Okay, good. Let's be optimists.
In previous months, and in some cases years, organizations have been very reluctant to broadly hire employees because of the potential administration change.
Yep.
In addition, many organizations were uncertain about their own future and have not, only just put off hiring decisions, but also gone through activities in order to keep the organization afloat, such as layoffs and downsizing.
Okay.
These activities have also included paring down of some benefits, such as 401k contributions, larger employee health care contributions, or the delay or elimination of salary increases and bonuses and layoffs and downsizing. But now that the elections are over, organizations, including government contractors, will feel much more confident in hiring 2013. So that's the good news.
You really think so?
I do. I have seen this trend go upwards for the past couple of years, and I think people were reluctant up to this point to start to hire, especially towards the end of the year and the end of the fiscal year for the government. I definitely see that trend heading upwards in the beginning of 2013, trending towards the middle of 2013 as well.
I mean, don't you think it depends on what happens with a fiscal cliff?
I think that could have something to do with it. However, I think that people are more concerned about their own personal finances than organizations are concerned.
Yeah. And taxes. I mean, my taxes are going up by $40,000 after the new year. So, and if I were hiring, I'm not going to hire somebody if I've got to pay, you know, them as well. I mean, I disagree with you a little bit on that. I think I represent a lot of government contractors and IT companies around the area. And the smaller businesses are really feeling the pinch, particularly those with more than 50 employees who are going to get hit with healthcare cost increases. Right. My healthcare cost increase, for example, just mine alone is going up by almost $200 a month next year because of the Obama legislation. So in any event, I like your optimism, and I want people to listen to Michael Heller, because I think if his optimism rubs off on the rest of us, maybe we'll just look past some of the challenges that we're facing right now. What do you see the hottest industries to be right now?
Well, if I had to pick a top three, I would say that IT is going to continue to trend upward. Healthcare and biotech, obviously, as well as finance. You know, there was a recent study in Computer World magazine that said that 33% of executive respondents said they plan to increase headcount in 2013. Now, again, 33% doesn't sound like a huge number, but that's up from 20% in 2009.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean, I'm looking for the increases in the economy. At some point, we have to recover. We've been stumbling along. So what do you think are the biggest challenges that are faced by companies in regard to hiring right now?
So I think one of the biggest challenges companies are going to face is that they're going to have a hard time retaining unengaged employees who are typically just biding their time right now until the market turns.
They're not being utilized? Is that what you're saying? Or when you say unengaged, what do you mean?
They're definitely being utilized, but what they're doing is they're coming to work, punching the clock, putting in their time, and then leaving to go home. They're not putting in any additional discretionary effort.
Wow.
That's the employee that you want to keep at your organization. So that's one aspect.
That's the person you want to keep?
The person who is engaged.
Oh, okay. The unengaged one, I was going to say, if they're punching the clock and they're just biding their time, then let's get rid of them.
Right. Now, the challenge that I think a lot of firms are going to face right now is that a lot of those employees who are unengaged can also be considered high performers when they are engaged.
Ah.
So that's going to be a dichotomy that these employers are going to need to face at some point in time when the economy, and it's going to turn, whether it's in 2013 or 2014 or some combination of the two.
I mean, you would know that based on past performance by looking at how they did in the past. They were high performers when they were engaged. But the question is, how do you get them engaged again?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a hard question to answer. I think that the other thing, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of companies out there have decreased the level of benefits throughout the course of the organization.
Right.
So they're going to need to devise this new strategy to increase those corporate benefits so that they can not only keep the employees that they have that they want to keep, but also attract new employees to the company with better benefits.
Yet still retain profitability and try to keep it working.
Absolutely.
That's tough. That's a tough one.
Right.
So what can an organization do to make the company attractive to employees that are now looking? I mean, especially if the economy turns around, we're going to have a demand for high performers, and the supply will slowly dwindle, so that, you know, we'll need to do something to incentivize them. What can we do to find these potential employees and keep them?
Right, sure. Well, some of the more obvious measures are making sure that your company has a strong website and online presence, to include actively using social media. There also needs to be a streamlined application process, one that's not cumbersome, because candidates will give up halfway through the application process. And to make sure that your interview structure really focuses on assessing candidates' behavioral and cultural fit, not just the technical and the functional fit. In addition, employers need to treat candidates with as much professionalism with which they would treat their clients. So in other words, making sure there's open and direct dialogue, and also timely follow-up, especially with those candidates that have been through multiple phases of the interview process and they don't hear anything back. Quite frankly, even though you've got a lot of great candidates coming in the door, it does not mean you're going to make offers to all of them, but you still want to make sure they walk out having had a great experience, or they have a good story to tell in the marketplace. And these are individuals that in the future could be potentially great candidates, and more importantly, potential clients for you. And these are also people that are more likely to refer good people to your organization. So I think, unfortunately, there are some companies that still don't really understand the impact of the interview process on their employment brand.
Yeah, I think you've made some really good points in that short statement. Number one, internet exposure. Number two, you want to make the application process easy to accomplish so that you don't turn off people who otherwise would be turned off by the application process. And you're also saying treat them like you would your customers. Treat them with great respect and professionalism so that they'll think about you positively, even if they don't get the job later on. Because they could be evangelists for your company.
Absolutely.
Out in the economy someday, you know, on their own.
Right. And Michael and I hear a lot from, you know, whether candidates or our own personal friends and their interview experiences, where let's say they'll come in and it looks like the person's reading their resume for the first time. They have no idea what the person's there to interview for. They're bored during the interview process. So the candidate in turn thinks, well, that's how it is during the interview process. What's it going to be like to work for that organization? So it's very, very critical to make sure that your interviewers know what they're looking for and that everything is very, very streamlined and effective.
Now, one of your expertise areas that you listed in your resume was talent management. What do you mean by that, and what can companies do to focus on that?
Right. Well, talent management really is more than just finding the right talent. It talks about bringing the talent into the organization, onboarding them and integrating them correctly, and also really focusing on managing, developing, assessing, and rewarding them. So really looking at the employee life cycle in a more strategic manner, which will really lead to increasing employee engagement, which is really the core objective.
Okay, so engagement as opposed to unengaged, which Michael was talking about, and talent management is keeping them engaged, keeping them happy, incentivizing them to work harder and be more productive and more profitable.
Right, but it's really important to make sure that the talent management activities are aligned with overall business goals and objective, and this needs to be something that's communicated internally and externally with regard to what that entails, and that's something that employees and job seekers alike are going to be looking for in organizations. What's the career development path here going to be like? Is that going to be supported by the organization as well as my direct supervisor? And the more you can speak to that as far as your employee value proposition or EVP, the better the likelihood of attracting the right talent to your organization. They in turn go ahead and impact the excellence of your culture, and that in turn brings more top talent to your organization.
So you're sort of giving me reasons as to why it's important for people to focus on engagement and talent management. And maybe you can give me a little bit more background on why do companies really care about employee engagement and talent management?
Sure, sure. And employee engagement, remember, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is an employee's desire to give its employer more discretionary effort, not just to walk in and punch the clock, you know, basically to go above and beyond what they would normally do during their business day.
Okay.
Or their general job description. You know, I would definitely rather have the person come in who's engaged versus the one who's disengaged, because they can lead to other problems within the organization as well.
So how do you know that this is true?
When you say, how do you know this is true? You mean in terms of, there's a lot of surveys that have been out there that have talked about engagement and, about systems on how to measure engagement.
Right. And quite frankly, there's a survey by SuccessFactors that indicates that there's actually a movement away from focusing on human resource management systems and more of a focus on talent management solutions. And there's also a study by the Hay Group that looked at the world's most admired companies, and they realized that the recipe for success includes things like a focus on strategic excellence, structures to sustain performance over time, achieving success through people, and also placing high value on leadership and talent development. So there's much more of a focus on utilizing people programs and measuring them against overall business goals and objectives, and really trying to quantify productivity of the employee.
How do you do that? I mean, you want to get people to work harder, right? And if they were manufacturing widgets, that's easy, right? Or if they're billing hours in the case of law firms, that's easy to measure too. But how do you measure performance generally in any organization where there's a lot of intangible stuff going on?
I think a lot of companies right now think of their annual assessments as a way to measure performance, but really those aren't the best indicators. You know, a great start to finding out how engaged your workforce is really the employee engagement survey. But remember, okay, that's just a start. It's a good way to baseline your firm's employee engagement is. And typically, this survey will ask employees questions around opportunities for growth, how they feel about their compensation, how they feel about work-life balance, and really whether or not they respect their own peers as well as the people that they're working for throughout the organization.
So these are perceptions of the employee.
That's correct.
Based on a survey that would be professionally conducted, and you gather the information, then you present the information back to the employer, correct?
That's right. And sometimes firms feel as though they can do an employee engagement survey themselves, but there are a lot of pitfalls that come along with that, one of which is if you're doing it yourself, employees are kind of reluctant to really be open and honest with you as to how they really feel for fear of losing their job.
Right. So, you know, you gather all this data and you analyze it. Is that something that you all do for your clients as well?
We do. That's one service offering that we can provide to our clients, is to help them figure out how engaged is their workforce. And we typically, and most firms will typically base that on a percentage. You know, your employee workforce is 35% engaged, or your workforce is 78% engaged. And that gives you the baseline. And then we would then provide helpful tips, strategies, and programs to get folks more engaged based on where they think their disengagement lies.
And then do you actually train them in how to do it? How to engage the employees?
We can. And what we'll do is we'll walk in and we'll coach them on how to engage your employees better, or what can we do to help you engage your employees better? What are some of the programs that can be put in place?
And one of the key things that you need to have is a robust communication strategy. So there's transparency and consistency in the communication. It's also important to train line managers, who are the ones dealing with employees on a regular basis. And, mm-hmm. you know, training in the areas of performance management, and being able to give feedback and effective communication. So really increasing accountability on the individual team and the leadership levels.
Are there any pitfalls in employee engagement?
Yes, to make sure that the organization and leadership are very committed and that they understand what to do with the data. You don't do surveys just for the sake of surveys. Otherwise, you just end up with another useless report. So you need to be able to report out on the findings and move the needle a little bit at a time. When you show progress in one area, you increase accountability and credibility, and then you can make progress in other areas.
Awesome. We're talking with Michael Heller and Sally Lee of Pillar One Consulting. If people want to get in touch with you, how do they get in touch with you?
The best way to get in touch with us is through our website, which is at www.pillar1consulting, all spelt out, all one word, .com.
Excellent. And thank you for all that insight on employee engagement and talent management and all the HR strategies that you might help impart to all of your clients and the listeners out there today.
Thank you,
Wayne. Thank you for having us on your show.
Yeah, and we hope this helps a lot of the companies that are out there listening to us today.
Excellent. Thanks for listening to Blueprint for Wealth. Join us next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 AM.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not